Good morning. Paul, that was fantastic. Inspirational, really. So I'm Adam Bowles. I'm with the School of Public Health at West Virginia University, and my colleague Tracy Jarrett and I work together in the Office of Health Services Research. I've been there for 12 years, and it's a position that I love. I fell in love with public health after coming there, and our partners mean the world to me. So this is really a story, not meant to be depressing, but meant to be honest, about what it's like to do public health in a state with incredible need, very, very difficult socioeconomic conditions, a lot of substance abuse, a lot of chronic health conditions, and why we're taking a different approach, really, to working with primary care in doing good population health. So what you'll see are a few stories about measurement, and about being accountable, and about using those data to inform practice and policy change in a way that is sustainable, and sustainable because it's coming from the ground up. We have different sectors in our state vying to be hubs for data, warehouses for data. We have so many competitions that it's really counterproductive. So rather than being a contender in that, I'm not. We're taking a totally different approach and helping to build the skill sets of our partners to do population health. We have nothing to disclose other than we're lofty and overly idealistic. A lot of our work takes place and is couched in different efforts within our state health department, the West Virginia Bureau for Public Health, the Office of Health Promotion and Chronic Disease. They have been a long-term supporter of ours, and you know, no one is here from this group, but it is good to say thank you. Hopefully you have somebody in your life like Cecil Pollard. He's the reason that I chose to stay in my position. I've been there for 12 years, and it's because of him, really. The way he looks at his job is that it's a process. So we have different kinds of grants that come in, different funding streams come and go, and that's okay. And he always reminds me that it's not a project, it's a process. So we keep focus on that mission of being a good partner and helping leave something lasting, which is increased skill sets, increased knowledge, more self-efficacy among our partners that they can do what they need to do with their own data. So I'm glad I've got a Cecil in my life. So Cecil Pollard's been director of our office for a little over 32 years now. And we do population health. The state map, kind of oddly colored on your left, those dots represent the clinics that we're working with. It's about 54 sites right now. And we're spread a little thin, but I think that we're spread to the point where we need to be. When you say population health to our partners, it usually means something different than what it might mean to our funders, right? Our funders might be interested in doing something about surveillance or looking at the state as a whole, but the partners in these clinics are concerned about their patient panels. You know, it's as simple as, okay, I've got an electronic health record, I'm putting all of this data in there, and like Paul described, you had a black hole for one of your slides. It's a lot like that, yeah. So how do I get data out? How do I know? Simple questions, my God, the simple questions like, how many patients with diabetes do we have, and how's their HbA1c control? You know, super simple things that we're still, as a state, grappling with. So In an ideal sense, maybe someday we'll have a health information network that's functional, you know. But for now, we have these pockets of good expertise all over the state. So we're working on getting to know those pockets and building them up. Paula, your presentation was fantastic. But you know, walking through the process of how do you move from data to knowledge and then knowledge to action. And you threw in wisdom, which was fantastic too. Over time, we've helped to build a practice-based research network. And a lot of folks didn't think that that could happen because of the essential disarray that our state has with, you know, 50 plus electronic health records, lots of partners that may or may not work together for political reasons, a lot of counterproductive stuff. All that aside, we're able to focus on some of the positives and help bring people together. And thanks to Tracy, we've been able to pull off a West Virginia-Kentucky health data collaborative, which is good. I think it's really good for a lot of partners in our state to think about somebody other than West Virginia for a change. Kentucky's a neighbor, right? And we share the same issues, same health problems. So building good partnerships across academic centers, across primary care centers, to share data, to share experiences, and to talk about what works and what doesn't work, that's pretty tremendous for us. And I'm really, my part here is to set Tracy up to talk about the crux of what we do, and I'll sit down in a moment. But in the middle is Jill Cochran. Jill is flat out inspirational to us. She's a nurse practitioner at a rural health clinic in an area of the state that has tremendous need, and she puts herself all out there every day to do good for her community. And they've had an electronic health record at this clinic for a long time. It was a black hole. So over the past year, we've helped build a quality improvement and a research infrastructure there so that they can internally get those data out and start analyzing them and know more even about their data quality, which is a big deal. And I'll come back to that after Tracy does her part. But Jill broke it down into something very simple. What do you want to know about your people? And I think that kind of perspective is really helpful to me, you know, someone who doesn't get to work in a clinic, someone who is at a university and inherently divorced from a lot of the boots on the ground things that our partners are doing. So folks like Jill keep me grounded, and we learn a lot from them about how to be a better partner and how to coach people through doing good population health. So just one more thing about our practice-based research network. If we didn't do things that were abundantly, relevantly, clearly useful for our partners, they wouldn't have us in their doors. They wouldn't invite us back. So the T3 and the T4 research is really essentially what we hit on, and we have to hit on that in order to be effective. So what are the implications for clinical practice? If we help a primary care center put a project together, it certainly has to address their needs, or they're not going to do it. It has to be relevant to their practice and policy change, or it's useless, and it won't be sustainable. And if we're not doing things that help that community, those patient populations, we're just not going to be invited back. So the T3, the T4 research is absolutely essential in what we do.
So as we worked with the partners throughout the state and with Jill Cochran in our FQHC in Southern West Virginia specifically, we've learned a lot about what components are necessary to really build a partnership that is able to use and utilize clinical data to make a meaningful difference with their patients and their communities. And we've identified six different components, essential components, to make that process and that partnership work. I'm going to go over each one individually, and they don't have to happen in sequence. They really need to be built out kind of at the same time. So one of the things that we really learned from Jill and many of our other clinical partners is we really need to start asking the right questions. When we Adam and I are researchers from an academic institution, and if we come in with a question and want to use electronic medical record data to answer that question, and it has absolutely no benefit to the patients in that community, we're going to get shut down. So we really need to start thinking about what kinds of questions are essential to making changes and clinically relevant changes to those communities. our physicians, our clinicians are asking questions of themselves all the time. Every time they see a patient at point of care, they are considering that person's family history, their social context, their patient history, the things that they know in the literature, things that have worked with other patients that have similar backgrounds as them. And they start to make those connections and come up with treatment plans. It's kind of like a qualitative assessment without actually doing it scientifically. They're really doing that qualitative data collection all the time. So we could come in with these big population health questions, but we found that if we start to build that from the ground up and start asking our clinicians, what do you want to know, as Jill said, what do you want to know about your people? And what can we find out through the data that's already available in your population? Because sometimes we have some pie-in-the-sky ideas and the data's just not there, or it's not quality data. So we have to know what data we do have to be able to make those questions happen. Also, what kinds of skills and resources do those patients and community members need to make those kinds of changes in their lives? Are they available in that community? Maybe they are, maybe they aren't. We work in a lot of rural communities in West Virginia. Some of them have really good resources and strong community ties, and some don't. Or those people aren't plugged into those community resources. What do our providers in these rural clinics need to enhance patient care? One of the things that we've really found is a strength in our rural communities is they've had to do more with less for a very long time. They are very innovative. And so they really can, with all the changes with the Affordable Care Act and the measurement that they need to do, they've done wonders with very, very little. So if there are things that we can bring to the table to enhance that point of care service for them, that's what we're going to try to do. Also, at what level can we best affect outcomes? Are we looking at point of care? Are we looking at better data management? Are we looking at population and community interventions? You know, lots of different kinds of questions that we can be asking ourselves. And how do we operationalize and measure outcomes? Now, Adam and I can look at, different definitions of things from the literature, but what really has a clinical outcome for those patients? And those are things that we need a clinical partner to help us answer. What is an active patient? Is it defined by a measurement that they're required to report? What does the clinician think an active patient is? Also, we need to be able to tell a story about what happened and report that back to our clinical partners and tell others about what happened. I'm going to try to speed it up because I'm sure that I could talk about this for an hour or so. The next, and I think Paul hit on this quite nicely with that black hole image, what data are out there? There's tons of data out there. It doesn't mean it's good. It doesn't mean you can benchmark one clinic in rural West Virginia against another because they're using different EHRs. Maybe the question is in practice analytics and not in the EHR. How do you connect the two? I think that researchers often come at this thinking that this health information network is already built. They can ask all kinds of wonderful research questions. It's just not true. Also, one of the things that we've been working with, especially with the Kentucky and West Virginia Collaborative, is who has access to the data. So who has access to your medical record for research purposes? So we've been working with the Data Governance Committee to set up a system to help those clinics that are involved in working with us to help us to understand who they want to have access to that data. We also have been looking at developing complementary skill sets, and this happens on a couple of levels. We've been talking a lot about training and research capacity, training the next generation of clinical researchers, and also researchers who want to work in clinics. So it has to kind of go both ways. We don't expect everybody to have every skill set. We really have to start to recognize that our clinical partners, our research partners, and our community are all bringing something different to the table and to really start to build on those strengths. We, as Adam said, we work very, very, very closely with the West Virginia Bureau for Public Health. And they really, this is a diagram about bridging community and primary care. And they're really helping us to do that. So with some funding available from them, we're we are really starting to be able to work out those referral processes where a patient is identified in a clinical setting, they're referred to a community resource, and they're able to link that back to the clinic so that their primary care physician has the information that they attended those clinical or those community activities to support their health and wellness. Finally, we also need to build up our rapid response research cycles. The research cycle in general, sometimes getting funding for a project will take years. Lots of rewrites, resubmissions, all of that. So that's way too long for people in a clinic who need those measurements right away. So what we've been working on with our clinical partners is to help very quickly identify problems and issues, making sure those have a clinically relevant focus, building the infrastructure, as I said, by looking at the data and kind of what shape it's in and the data quality, which Adam will talk about. The ability to quickly respond to funding opportunities if they're out there, identifying appropriate intervention strategies and disseminating. And finally, one of the things that we try very hard to do is to go back to our clinic with our data, present it to the clinicians at the clinic, and hear what they have to say about it. And I think this is a very important part of the process because it really helps to identify where the gaps are in the community resources, and it goes back to those questions. What resources do we have? What do we need? How do we get people to the right place? I'm going to let Adam talk about some of the challenges with data quality.
Sure. How much time do we have, by the way? 3 minutes. Ample. So I'll make this snappy. This is a photo of Emma White. Emma's a nurse in Spencer, West Virginia, and she is a quality improvement machine. Much like Jill Cochran, she's flat-out inspirational. And they have a shoestring budget, essentially, but they are the only site in West Virginia to win the 2014 Million Hearts Hypertension Control Challenge. And the way in which they did that was so simple. They have a motivated nurse, a dedicated provider, and a lot of access and interest in using their data. So they presented at our State Academy of Family Physicians conference about that model, that, you know, regardless of your resources, you too can pull this off. They talked about essential components. I probably have 2 minutes, so this is going to be quick. I apologize. Data quality is a huge deal everywhere. We were funded through the state to do a high blood pressure training and measurement effort with primary care centers around the state. As we established baseline, the story that I consistently got from these centers were, we have more patients than that. We have more patients than that, as we tried to find patients with high blood pressure. Well, as it turns out, there's different ways of coding high blood pressure in the EHR, of course, right? So these are 11 sites. You've got model A, where you can look at ICD-9 or ICD-10 codes and find a version of truth in number of patients. You've got model B, where you can look at the coding plus the various 123 ways I found of misspelling hypertension, so you have a better indication of truth. Then you can, oh my goodness, actually look at their blood pressure, hey, and find a closer version of true. So you can see that overall, there's you'd miss almost 15% of patients with high blood pressure if you only looked at coding. And this is graphically truer on the far right. So how are we on time? Do I have a minute? 1 minute? Okay. And in terms of helping to allow our sites to innovate, there's a lot of interest in identifying diabetes risk, which is great. And there's these paper and pencil tests, which are fine, but there's so much data that can be scooped up and used easily for that. So with 14 sites, we went through a process of helping them mine their electronic medical records data to find that potential patient pool. So who doesn't have diabetes? Who doesn't have prediabetes? 94,283 in this cohort. But among those, you have 10,673, or 11.3%, that do have significant risk for diabetes that can be found now. So we help to, and we're still helping to build referral systems to get these folks linked up with lifestyle modification programs. we do a lot of data visualization also. So taking their data, mapping it by zip codes and other more discrete ways. So that's what we do. Thank you for your time.